It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
SmackDown sucks. It's almost as bad as Raw.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
This is episode 739 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, January 16th, 2022. Today is a momentous day. It marks day number 504 for Roman Reigns as the Universal Champion, which officially makes him the longest reigning Universal Champion in WWE history. It's not a long history. It's a little over 5 years since the title was created, but it's history nonetheless. There is other news, too. As I was about to begin recording, I saw a tweet from Mustafa Ali, who has been MIA from WWE television for a while now. He announced that he has requested his release from WWE, posting, "I have a message that is much bigger than my dreams in pro wrestling. Despite my best efforts, I will not be able to deliver this message while working for WWE. Therefore, I am requesting my release from WWE." When their best idea on what to do with him a few months ago was to start a "you hate me because I'm Muslim" gimmick, yeah, "you hate me because of my name and what that means and what that represents," that's where they look to be going with that angle. When you realize that that's the best that WWE could come up with for this guy, he had the failed retribution angle. You know, he tried with it, but that thing was fucking, you know, dead from day one. And the best they could come up with for him is this ridiculous gimmick. If that's the best you can come up with for this guy, then he's better off leaving and taking his talents somewhere else. And based on that message, that may not be another wrestling company. You know, it sounds like he may have plans that go beyond the wrestling ring. I do know that he was lobbying as recently as last week to be cast as the, I think, the main character in this new Marvel Studios Blade movie that they're doing, which I think is a reboot, I think. But they're doing this Blade movie, and he was on social media asking people to, you know, tweet him as a potential, you know, candidate for this new role. If he actually were to get the role, let's be honest, WWE probably wouldn't let him do it anyway. They'd offer fucking Happy Corbin or something. Even though they're looking to cast a South Asian male. Yeah, we got Shanky. Give him Shanky instead, pal. Oh my God. You know, I'll just say this. If his request is granted, and I hope that it is, if his request is granted, I wish him all the success in the world. If you follow Ali on social media, outside of being very good at his job, he's a quality human being too. And I like to see good things happen to good people. Always bet on yourself, and you'll never lose. If you want to support the podcast, you may do so, thesolomonster.com. You will find the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. Bet on me. Huh? Bet on the Solo Monster, and I'll never let you down. But $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. I want to shout out our PayPal producers for this week, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker, Naif Al-Safar, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Big Bear, Brian Pissarra, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Killshot, Keith Hart, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Caleb Showtime Lindley, John Raging Mad Riffle, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, the Goddess of Justice, Samantha Turner, Road Rage Ricardo James, first-time donator. Welcome, Ricardo. Also, happy birthday to Cordaro, who turns 35 today. I know he's listening. Shout-out to one of the members of our extended sound-off community, Sean, who lost his dog, Kai, on Monday, and wanted to remind all the pet owners out there to enjoy every second with their loyal companion, because you never know when that time might come to an end. I know that pain all too well, and it sucks. So I endorse his message. And again, very sorry to hear about Kai. The 9th annual Royal Rumble Facebook pool is up and running. I mentioned it for the first time last week. We have over, last I checked, I think it was over 1,200, bordering on 1,300 entries so far this year. Very easy to enter. All you have to do, if you are in the private group, the private Solo Monster Sounds Off group on Facebook, just find Zach Hulker's Rumble pool post. I have pinned it to the top of the page in the announcement section. All you have to do is hit the like button. That's it. If you like Zach's post, you're in. You don't even have to post a comment. He'll go through all the likes and make sure you're in there. Numbers, random numbers will be assigned to everybody the Saturday before the Rumble, which is next Saturday. But you can still enter the contest up until a few hours before the pay-per-view. And the way it works is that each person will receive a random number to be issued by Zach. That number is going to be your number for the men's and the women's Rumble matches. So if you draw number 20 and the number 20 entrant in either Rumble were to win, you would win your pool. And then you would move on to the ultimate final Royal Rumble pool. And we'll pick a first, second, and third place winner. There's going to be prizes involved. Zach and Julian Cannon, they have all the details. It's all up in the post. All you got to do is just go there and you will find all of the information. Looking forward to finding out what my number is. Although I will not, if I were to win, I will forego the prizes. I mean, that wouldn't be right. But I always have fun taking part in this as well. And if you're not in the private group, just search Solo Monster Sounds Off on Facebook. It's not the page. It's a group. There's a page, there's a group. You'll have to be approved for membership before you can be allowed in. So there you go. That is the place to go. Always fun. Speaking of fun, House of Glory crowned a new women's champion on Friday in a one-night tournament that included Deonna Purrazzo, who just won the Ring of Honor women's title on Impact the night before. She beat Roxy. Jordynne Grace, Mercedes Martinez, who is now All Elite. Sumi Sakai, celebrating 25 years in the business. This is her final year in the ring. Santana Garrett, Jenai Kai, Natalia Markova, and Violet, who is our first House of Glory Women's Champion. Some really good matches here. The ladies killed it. I will say, you know, when I learned that Markova was involved in this tournament, Natalia Markova, I was not familiar with her. I was not familiar with her work. I went and I studied up, you know, on some of her matches. She is a former Shine Women's Champion. She just made her NWA Power debut just the other week. Having watched her here in this tournament on Friday night, she was very impressive. And she bested some big names to win the entire thing. It came down to her and Jordynne Grace in the finals. Natalia Markova is the new House of Glory Women's Champion. I don't know if the show is going to be up on Fight by the time you listen to this. It is supposed to be airing on Fight. Not live, obviously. Not this time. But it should be going up there in the next day or two. That's kind of what I'm hoping. So if you want to check it out, that will be the place to do so. I had a lot of fun calling the action with JD from New York and Sam Laterna, who joined us for the occasion. Already plans in the works for the next several months. You know, our next show is on Saturday, February 12th. So if you are around the New York City area, hogwrestling.net is the place to go for tickets. If you see me, don't be a stranger. Say hello. I won't bite. I promise. This past Wednesday marked 30 years since one of the most famous segments in WWE history aired on Wrestling Challenge. It was taped in December of 91, but it aired on January 12, 1992. That being the barbershop incident where Marty Jannetty dove through the glass window of Brutus Beefcake's barbershop. You remember, in an attempt to evade his tag team partner Shawn Michaels like the coward that he is. There aren't very many interview segments that are still talked about that long after they happened. I mean, obviously, the first one you think of is probably the Coconut Incident with Jimmy Snuka on Piper's Pit, Andre the Giant challenging Hulk Hogan on Piper's Pit to a match at WrestleMania. Those really are the only two that are even comparable, I think, to this one. I mean, there's a t-shirt company named after it. Barbershop Window. But that really set Shawn Michaels on his path as a single star. And of course, the rest is history. But I bring this up because there is another 30-year anniversary coming up this Wednesday for the greatest Royal Rumble match in history. The 1992 Royal Rumble, the first to be contested for the WWE Championship, which was vacant at the time, features the greatest commentary job that I have ever heard in my life from Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby Heenan. It was the Bobby the Brain Heenan show that night. For me, you know, yes, it's nostalgia from a time that I was growing up as a wrestling fan, but there's a lot of nostalgia that doesn't hold up. It's a match that still, for me, has infinite replay value. I love it so much. And so I wanted to do something special for the anniversary. And so this Wednesday, January 19th, to the day, I will be doing a live watch-along exclusively for YouTube channel members. There's been some confusion on this. Channel members are different from channel subscribers. You should absolutely be subscribed to the channel already. For all the other content that's on there. But channel membership is a paid feature for those who want to support me and my work, and they want a few extra perks thrown in like bonus content. So this is going to be for channel members who want to hang out for about 90 minutes or so. WWE uploaded the entire match for free last year to its YouTube channel, so we're going to use that. I will give you the timestamp on Peacock that we're going to be starting from if you prefer to use that. And we'll watch the match together and talk about it. I'm going to put a poll up in the community section for members to vote on what time you would prefer to do it. It's going to be earlier in the day. I can tell you that right now. It's going to be sometime between 11 a.m. Eastern and maybe 2 p.m. Eastern, somewhere in that time frame. I'll let you guys vote, and then we'll go from there. So I will keep you posted. If you want to become a channel member, I don't think you can sign up on mobile. You need to do it on your desktop. I've had people say, I don't see the join button, because they're on their phone. So you have to do it on your desktop. But the join button is right there under pretty much every video on the channel that you, once you click on it, and you'll see that white join button. So anyway, this is going to be for all levels, regardless of which tier you are on. So come hang out with me during the day on Wednesday. Then I'll come back that night and we'll talk about AEW Dynamite. Shout out to Dan, by the way. I saw that Dan picked up that Rumble Like It's 1992 shirt in our Pro Wrestling Tee store earlier today. So thank you, sir. Now you can Rumble Like It's 1992 every day. We got a lot of news to get into here. And we're going to start with this because this, you know, on its face could potentially be a big deal. Even though in the end, I'm not sure this is going to really amount to much. But MLW filed a 19-page antitrust lawsuit against World Wrestling Entertainment on Tuesday, alleging intentional interference with contractual relations, intentional interference with prospective economic relations, and a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act, among other things. WWE has yet to officially be served with the lawsuit. Once that happens, they will have 3 weeks to respond to the allegations. Per PW Insider, MLW states that they are filing the lawsuit because of the, quote, egregious efforts of professional wrestling company WWE to destroy its competitor MLW's business and maintain its dominance of the U.S. broadcasting market for professional wrestling by unlawfully interfering with MLW's access to media markets and wrestling talent. And the suit claims that since purchasing WCW in 2001, WWE has maintained control of 85% of the professional wrestling sphere, alleging that it is maintaining its dominance through unfair and anti-competitive business practices, including poaching talent, misappropriating confidential information, interfering with competitors' contracts, and cutting off competitors' access to their viewing audiences. And it also states that with WWE's popularity declining over the past 5 years due to, among other things, inferior content. I laughed out loud when I read that. It's funny because it's true. They allege the company has targeted MLW with unlawful predatory conduct, including airing without authority MLW wrestling footage, inducing MLW wrestlers under exclusive contracts with MLW to terminate those contracts, and encouraging MLW wrestlers to breach their contracts with the company by disclosing MLW's confidential and proprietary business information. Here's some more color, not just from PW Insider, but this also comes from this week's Observer. on the core claims. These are the most important points of the lawsuit, because I ain't reading all 19 pages here, but this is kind of what it boils down to here. WWE, according to MLW, interfered with their broadcasting agreement with Vice TV. MLW and Vice reached an agreement last May for MLW to air archived footage, and they were also negotiating to expand the agreement to include airing new content as well. The claim is that Susan Levison, a senior vice president at WWE, called Vice executives to tell them that Vince McMahon was pissed that Vice was airing MLW content and wanted Vice to stop doing so. And the lawsuit claims that the Vice executive told Levison, "I think this is illegal what you're doing," and claimed the executive told Levison that this was probably an antitrust violation, to which Levison responded that she cannot control McMahon. And the claim is that WWE had considerable leverage on Vice because wrestling was an important part of their programming. Now, obviously, Dark Side of the Ring is their big, I don't even know if I can say moneymaker, but it's their big wrestling show. And we still don't know, by the way, if that's been greenlit for a fourth season. And Vice needed WWE, the dominant company, to ensure the success of Dark Side of the Ring. The suit claims WWE's interference caused Vice to pull out of all negotiations and only one MLW show aired. Vice's idea was a one-hour wrestling show after Dark Side of the Ring as a way to keep the high number of viewers from that show for another hour. The station was hoping to retain half of those viewers with the new MLW show. However, viewership of the first MLW show on October 7th was about 40,000 total. And Vice then never aired another episode. They mention in the suit, MLW does, that A&E, which aired those WWE documentary specials last year and the Most Wanted Treasure show with Top Dollar, they mention that A&E owns 40% of Vice. The implication being that that ownership stake may have led to pressure not to carry MLW had WWE requested that they not carry MLW. And there's also the claim that the network needs to be on WWE's good side for Dark Side of the Ring. That makes very little sense to me when you consider the fact that public enemy number one in most of those Dark Side of the Ring episodes has been Vince McMahon and WWE. In fact, I would always get messages, "Oh, this show is such a hit job on WWE. All it does is bash Vince McMahon." And there are episodes that have nothing to do with WWE, but yeah, a lot of them, they don't paint Vince McMahon and WWE in a very kind light. I mean, that is true. Not because I think they're making shit up, but because this is how the story goes. And these are things that Vince McMahon and WWE have done and said in the past. But the fact that, again, they're painted in such a poor light on most of those episodes. Nor does WWE clearly give them permission to use any of their footage. You know, that's something Vice does on its own. You can tell because the quality and the way, you know, the footage they use is not great. But because it's a documentary, I think they can get away with using it. But it's not as if WWE is providing them with, HD footage for them to use. So I'm skeptical of that. Now, they did get Jerry McDevitt, WWE's lawyer, to be interviewed for the steroid trial episode. But the idea that Vice needs to play nice with WWE because of Dark Side of the Ring is comical, considering how they're portrayed. Another claim is that last July, MLW entered into a lucrative agreement with Tubi, a California-based streaming service owned by Fox. Tubi TV. I have that app, in fact, on my Roku. The agreement would have had a profound impact on MLW's business by giving it exposure to Fox's broad television and NFL audience, further positioning them for future media deals. When WWE found out about the agreement, they contacted a Tubi executive located in their headquarters in San Francisco and threatened that if Tubi did not terminate the MLW contract, WWE would cease doing business with Fox and would pull important WWE programs from Fox platform. Now, let me stop there. Maybe that threat was made, but the idea that WWE has a billion-dollar agreement over, I think it's a 5-year period, for SmackDown, right, with Fox, But if they dare air MLW programming on one of their streaming services, the WWE is going to pull the plug. It reminds me of all those years ago when Vince McMahon, this is the early years of WrestleMania, right? I think this was 88 probably, WrestleMania 4. And Vince McMahon is writing letters to and making all these threats to the cable carriers that if you carry this NWA show, you're going to lose WrestleMania. Was Vince McMahon actually going to pull WrestleMania from all of these different cable services and slice, you know, the amount of money that he was going to make? Of course not. Of course not. But that was the threat, and it was actually very effective. So we've seen examples of this before. The idea that WWE would somehow harm or sacrifice a $1 billion deal with Fox and withhold programming or terminate the deal if they were to get in bed with MLW on their streaming platform, again, it's just fucking comical. Fucking comical. But MLW contends that soon thereafter, and just before MLW content was to begin airing on Tubi, the MLW contract was terminated, resulting in substantial losses to MLW and harm to customers. They said the deal would make them more attractive to signing new talent, and they had new shows like this Azteca Underground thing, and they had hired a bunch of new, you know, editors and a new PR agency. I mean, MLW was really getting ready to make big moves with this Tubi deal. And then, you know, the deal was included in an August 10th public announcement. That was the idea. There was going to be a public announcement on August 10th. A September 11th launch. The claim is that on or about August 9th, the night before the press release was to go out, Stephanie McMahon talked to a Tubi executive in California about the deal. The claim is that she first talked about moving MLW off the agreed upon Tuesday night at 8 p.m. slot because it was the same time as NXT. And the quote here is, but Ms. McMahon ultimately pressured the Tubi executive and other senior executives at Fox to terminate the agreement in its entirety. Tubi's affiliate, Fox, could lose WWE's business or preferred content if Tubi did not acquiesce to their demand and terminate its agreement with MLW. On August 9th, the night before a planned press release about the Tubi deal was to go out, as a result of WWE's pressure and interference, MLW received a letter purporting to terminate the license agreement. And then there's a bunch of other things here that are alleged as well about, you know, tampering in terms of talent contracts. There was a Fight TV deal. Allegedly, they had approached MLW with a media rights deal. And MLW started to, talk to them, but Fight pulled out of those talks. And MLW claims that Fight's executive advisor of corporate development was at the same time working for WWE as a senior vice president. And the lawsuit claims the WWE's interference in the Tubi agreement reversed momentum that the company had at the time with fans. And that it cut off their access to a broader fan base, and it resulted in, you know, 40% drop in ticket sales within a matter of weeks, and it just led MLW down a very bad road. The Tubi deal falling through because of WWE, I absolutely believe. Because even I can remember Court Bauer was teasing around that time last summer a major announcement that was going to be transformative for their company. And then that announcement never came. And now we know that at least some members of the media had the press release in hand. They had it sent to them in advance, you know, from MLW for release the next morning, but they were never given the green light to go ahead and publish it. That's called an embargo. I've written hundreds of press releases in my life. As a PR practitioner, it's common practice to distribute it to at least some media members in advance of whatever it is that you're announcing. It could be an event, it could be a new product launch, whatever it is. You give them the release in advance with the understanding that it's under embargo and it's not to be published until a specific date and time. So let's say it's, you know, 2 days from now at 9 a.m., it's written usually in red ink at the top of the press release. This is not to go out. This is embargoed until whatever date, 9 a.m. And that way, everybody reports it all at once. That's standard practice. It sounds like that's probably what happened here, only that embargo was never lifted because the deal fell through. For whatever the reason, the deal fell through. Per the Observer, there was industry talk that WWE and Fox were not on the best of terms at one point, so much so that Fox, through Tubi, was ready to make a non-WWE wrestling deal, which would have been MLW. And then certain moves were made, including Brock Lesnar going to SmackDown. There was a SmackDown show that got moved to the Staples Center, which is where Fox is located in Los Angeles. WWE officials outright said that was done for Fox, so that Fox could get a SmackDown show in its home city. That all took place around the same time frame of Tubi pulling out of its deal with MLW. Now, Jerry McDevitt gave a quote, the one and only, the infamous Jerry McDevitt. He said, "I have not seen the full lawsuit since WWE has not yet been served. If Tubi breached, then sue Tubi. As to Vice, WWE has no commercial relationship with them, or for that matter, any of the other dozens of content distribution entities with whom MLW could do a deal with if they had a commercially viable product. They put a show on Vice, if my memory serves me correctly, after one of the Dark Side shows, and lost most of its audience. I think I read that they got 40,000 viewers. No wonder Vice did no further deal." A very McDevitt-esque statement. So that is WWE's position at this point. You know, WWE making moves to hurt other promotions is hardly a new phenomenon. They've done that for decades, long before they were publicly traded. They still do it today. The Pizzagate stuff after the Chris Jericho-Nick Gage match where they were allegedly shopping stories around to media people to see who would bite on it to try to make AEW look bad. You know, keeping other promotions from running specific buildings. They tried to screw Ring of Honor out of their Madison Square Garden booking a few years ago for the big supercard with New Japan. That was WrestleMania weekend. So I can believe that they screwed with or tried to screw with MLW in some way because they have a history of it, even with companies that you would look at and think they're no great threat to WWE. So why would they care? Why would they care about MLW? But they do it anyway because they can. Because they want the market to themselves. And if anybody starts to gain any kind of traction, any kind of foothold, no matter how small, they have to try to squash it. You know, even if publicly they claim, oh, our product is different from what these wrestling companies do. We don't just do wrestling. And we don't see them as competition. Of course they do. We know they do. They're part of the same carny industry that all these other promotions are part of. It's just that they're a lot bigger and they have more resources at their disposal. They have more money. Which is why it's so hard to beat them in court. You know, MLW is asking for a jury trial. They're asking for damages to be determined at the time of said trial. I doubt this ever even goes to trial. And MLW is taking a real risk here because there's no doubt that their business has taken a hit. You know, is it because of WWE, as they allege? Is it because the pandemic stifled whatever momentum they were building? Or is it because people just lost interest in the MLW product? You know, if they're hurting for cash and they fight this and they lose, they stand to take a huge hit just in legal costs alone. Because if there's one thing WWE has lots of, it's money. So I would think they're hoping for a settlement long before this ever gets to a jury trial. And if the Tubi TV stuff can be proven, and that's the thing, like I hear about this Vice stuff, like can it be proven? If the Tubi stuff can be proven, then maybe they could get a little something out of that because I do think they got a raw deal on that. But otherwise, I think it's unlikely that this goes anywhere. The Toronto Star published a story yesterday on its website titled, "Can Tony Khan's AEW Beat Vince McMahon and WWE at Its Own Game?" And you can surmise what that article is about just from the headline, but it caused some headlines yesterday based off of a quote that WWE gave to the writer about what AEW is doing. Now, Wade Keller of the Pro Wrestling Torch, I've been a guest on Wade's shows on the Torch in the past many times before. He was interviewed and he talked about AEW having more authentic sounding, unscripted interviews and more violence than you would find on WWE television these days. He said, Vince McMahon's inner circle are as disconnected from what's cool and attractive to the 18 to 35-year-old audience as he is. And he isn't feeling any urgency to stray from his decades-long proclivities and preferences that have largely served him well over the years. Which is true. It's why you hear me and a lot of other people use the word formulaic for a lot of what we see on WWE television. It's a formula that he does not like to stray from because he still makes money with it. And then came this part. In an exclusive statement provided to the Star, WWE referenced a bloody women's tag team match put on by their competition, where Penelope Ford and The Bunny took on Ty Conti and Anna Jay on AEW's December 31st Rampage show. They said that that is not what they are willing to do. Their statement reads as follows. If you look at the gory self-mutilation that bloodied several women in the December 31st event on TNT, it quickly becomes clear that these are very different businesses. We had an edgier product in the Attitude Era, and in a 2022 world, we don't believe that type of dangerous and brutal display is appealing to network partners, sponsors, venues, children, or the general public as a whole. I could do without some of the excessive blood and blading that they do in AEW. I think there's a time and a place for it. It worked well, I thought, in the title matches between Hangman Page and Bryan Danielson, for example, you know, getting some color. Or even in the cage match at All Out last year with the Lucha Brothers and the Young Bucks. I do think AEW goes a little overboard with it sometimes. But WWE acting all morally superior is the funniest shit that I have read in days. It's only been days. I can't even say weeks or months. It's only been days since Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan opened their mouths and embarrassed themselves as their brains continue to rot. But this is almost as amusing. That statement was probably written by Vince McMahon himself, or dictated by Vince McMahon himself. That is absolutely a Vince McMahon statement, right down to using the word self-mutilation. He literally wrote letters to Ted Turner in 1996 asking him to stop the practice of self-mutilation on WCW shows when the wrestlers would blade themselves. He was talking about how Hulk Hogan now on television for weeks has been blade, you know, whatever word it was that he used, but, you know, he's been bleeding all over the place. And how he hoped that Ted stockholders held him accountable for this unethical practice. Vince McMahon could not give 15 shits about blading or unethical practices. He made himself a billionaire off unethical practices. I just talked about some of them when I was discussing the MLW lawsuit. He was trying to fuck over WCW at a time when Turner was looking to merge with Time Warner, which they eventually did later that same year. It was more than just a few letters that he wrote. He was publicly, for months, he was publicly trying to dirty up WCW as much as possible with the hope that the deal wouldn't happen. He wasn't above blading or having blood on his own television. He only whined about it because he felt that he either couldn't do it or he just preferred not to do it. But because they were doing it, he felt that it put WWE at a competitive disadvantage. If it wasn't for those sponsors and network partners they talk about, they wouldn't hesitate for a second to put matches like that on TV if he thought that it would sell tickets or move the ratings needle. Not because they have any sort of moral code. You're out of your fucking mind. Moral code. The idea that he would only mention the Attitude Era as if they haven't done anything like that in the 25 years that have come since then is a fucking riot, considering it was only 6 years ago, and I can't even believe it's been that long, but it was only 6 years ago at SummerSlam they had Brock Lesnar intentionally split open Randy Orton's skull with hardway elbows. The man was bleeding all over the place, and approving something like that, I think, is actually far more dangerous than blading. You could say, oh, blading is more barbaric. I think coming up with an idea, here's what we're going to do in our match tonight, or this is what Brock wants to do, so we'll let him do what he wants to do, and having a guy go out there and actually take his forearm or take the point of his elbow and open up another human being on purpose, and that Orton's bleeding all over the place, I think that's worse. That's far more dangerous than blading. to purposefully open somebody up like that. Orton is a fucking maniac for even agreeing to that. So is John Cena when Brock did that to him at Extreme Rules when Lesnar first came back to the company. It's actually 10 years ago. So spare me the self-righteous bullshit. Let's be honest about why they made that statement. It's because there were women involved. That's the only reason they singled out that match. That's it. They think it's barbaric seeing four women bleeding on TV. Meanwhile, Britt Baker and Thunder Rosa had one of the best matches all year in 2021, which helped elevate Britt Baker to superstar status in that company. She was already a star, but then that just elevated her to the next level. So I think it's fine to call out Tony Khan and AEW when they get excessive with it. There's a time and a place where that kind of thing works, and it shouldn't matter what you've got between your legs. And you know what? Maybe WWE's network partners don't like it, but TNT doesn't seem to have a problem with it, or they would have put the kibosh on this after the first time they did it. But WWE taking the moral high ground will never not be funny to me. It'd be like Hulk Hogan being named an ambassador for the NAACP. AEW Dynamite on Wednesday had the match between CM Punk and Wardlow. And I talked about this on the stream on Wednesday night because there was a lot of divided opinion about this match. There were people like myself who thought that what they did, you know, largely made sense. It progressed things. It was probably the best outcome that they could have done instead of beating one person clean over the other, because I don't think it would have been the right time to... I know it wouldn't have been the right time to beat Punk, because he should not be losing before he faces MJF. But the way they did it, I thought, was smart in that they kept Wardlow strong the entire time. It looked like Punk just couldn't figure out how to beat this guy. Wardlow looked dominant for the 98% of the match, I would say. Ended up powerbombing Punk about 7 or 8 times total throughout the match. Would have had him beat. Had him dead to rights were it not for MJF stopping the count, telling him to do more, punish him some more, powerbomb him on the timekeeper's table outside the ring. You know, if there's one thing I would have changed, I would have probably, when he did that powerbomb, I would have had him get disqualified. I know AEW doesn't like doing DQ finishes. I would have had Wardlow get disqualified for that, because you get to the same place where Wardlow can be upset and he can blame MJF for telling him to do that in the first place. So you kind of, you see what I mean? You get back to the same place. But beyond that, you know, we can say whether it should have been a DQ or, you know, you have Punk do what he did, which was in the end, he surprised Wardlow with a very weak, you know, inside cradle, and he surprised him. And so he pinned him. So Wardlow did technically get pinned. But I don't think anybody watching that match would come away from that match thinking, oh boy, you know, Wardlow, boy, he was made to look really weak. You know, Wardlow dominated this fucker. Had the match won, and the only reason he didn't win is because of MJF. And when the match was over, the place looked like they were about to just explode in a building where they weren't really all that enthusiastic throughout the night. They weren't a very loud crowd, but they badly wanted to see Wardlow turn against MJF. So they're building two things at once. They're building to a Punk-MJF match, but they're also building to a split between Wardlow and MJF. And I saw some people, I know Lance Storm, even some wrestlers, he was one who thought it was very damaging to CM Punk what they did and to people's overall interest in seeing Punk wrestle MJF. I disagree. I understand what he's saying. It didn't diminish my interest personally in seeing that match. I want to see both. I want to see Punk and MJF, but I also want to see Wardlow and MJF and what happens next with the two of them. Because as I've said before, Wardlow is going to be a big deal. He's going to be a big babyface in this company. And speaking of Wardlow, WrestleVotes tweeted on Wednesday. This is before the match aired between Punk and Wardlow. WrestleVotes said, with his biggest match to date happening later tonight, I can confirm without hesitation that WWE will be extremely interested in luring Wardlow away from AEW when his contract is due. There are several people within WWE that love his potential. And water is wet and grass is green. Yes, of course, WWE would be stupid not to have interest in Wardlow. You look at the guy, just physically, compared to a lot of the people they have on their roster today, you can see why they would have an interest in him. Wardlow had just done an interview with PW Insider and talked about wanting to be an AEW lifer. So the timing of this is very interesting. He said, in 10 or 20 years, I'm going to be so excited and proud to look back and say that I was one of the AEW originals that means so much to me because my career started, you know, obviously I did some indies, but the world didn't know me. As far as the world knows, my career started with AEW, and it's going to end with AEW. And I look forward to accomplishing and growing as much as humanly possible and reaching the stars throughout the next 10 years. And he goes on to talk, you know, he credits Tony Khan and Omega and Cody and the Bucks and all the founding fathers of AEW for, you know, giving him the opportunity and treating him like gold. He said, I'm very, very happy with AEW and the way that I'm treated. So the idea that Wardlow would go to WWE seems unlikely. Now, I don't know when his contract is up. You know, MJF has talked, they've even talked about it on TV. His contract still has 2 years left. I don't know if Wardlow has a year, 2 years, 3 years, that I don't know. And I don't think he's publicly said. Things can change. Happy now, not so happy a year from now. There are people who probably came over from WWE who came to AEW. Happy to be gone from there. Looking for an opportunity. So happy to be in AEW. It's like getting out of Shawshank. Who now may not be so happy. Because they have such a big roster that not everybody is getting equal time on television. So I'm sure there are some very unhappy and frustrated people. I mean, Big Swole sort of alluded to that, you know, recently. But for now, Wardlow seems very happy. He seems intent to be a lifer in that company. He's got no reason to leave. He has no reason to leave. You're trading one billionaire for another. I think they'll take care of Wardlow. I don't think they're going to shortchange the guy. I think he'll make good money, and I think they'll give him the best chance to grow into a big star and not, you know, sort of get lost in the shuffle, or they get bored of him and they move on to somebody else, like has happened to so many other people. So the idea that he would leave and go to WWE, I'm sure WWE would love it, but that ain't going to happen. Lance Archer is back. He attacked Hangman Adam Page. Left him laying, which I'm going to say sets up for a title match at Beach Break. I think that, you know, Revolution is still a ways away. I don't know that Archer is the strongest challenger they could come up with for a pay-per-view match or a pay-per-view main event. I even made the comment on Wednesday. I said, if their intent is to go to Revolution with that as the championship match, I don't think you close out the show with that. If they were going to do Britt Baker and Thunder Rosa, I think that would be a stronger match to close out. Revolution with, maybe in a cage. But they got their big Beach Break show coming up in Cleveland in a couple of weeks, and I can see that being the title match, or at least the first match, being set up for that show. Archer's been out since October. He landed on his head in his match with Eddie Kingston, and so it's good to see him back and healthy again. Brody King finally showed up to aid Malakai Black. He signed pretty much right after Ring of Honor announced that they were going to be going dark for a few months. So I assume that means his deal was probably inked back in November and they kept it quiet, even though people were kind of murmuring about it. And they kept him off television until this week. He and Malakai Black are the tag team champions in PWG. They're very familiar with each other. I think it'd be great to add them to the tag team division, but I don't want that to happen at the expense of Malakai doing singles matches. I'd like to see him doing both. But Brody King is the second Ring of Honor pickup after Jay Lethal. We still don't know if the Briscoes are going to be coming in. Tony Khan made a comment this week sort of saying that, well, you know, we have a lot of people already. They're a really talented team. But, you know, making it sound like there's no room for the Briscoes, I don't buy that for a second. I think he's throwing us off the scent, and it's only a matter of time before they come in and work a match or a whole program with FTR. Now, Dynamite this Wednesday has Adam Cole and Britt Baker as partners for the first time in AEW against Orange Cassidy and Chris Statlander. CM Punk is facing Shawn Spears at the request of MJF. Serena Deeb takes on Sky Blue. Sting and Darby Allin take on the Acclaimed. And the TNT champion, Cody Rhodes, out of quarantine, back on Dynamite this week. I'm so glad we have an interim champion. After Cody missed, 7 days, 10 days? And I'm wondering if we might also see Jon Moxley. I was surprised to not see him on the show this week. He clearly is ready to come back. This is their last chance on Wednesday before the GCW pay-per-view next Sunday, because Moxley is going to be on that show. And so if they want him back on AEW first, get that big first-time pop back, it's now or never. You know, they either do it this week or GCW gets him first. Moxley is going to be defending his GCW world title next Sunday against Homicide. It's going to be their first match in more than a decade. Since 2011, they wrestled at a Dragon Gate USA show. It will be the world on GCW from the Hammerstein Ballroom, sold out in New York City. The biggest event in GCW history, not only airing on Fight TV, but on traditional pay-per-view as well. And the full card has Moxley against Homicide, Ring of Honor World Champion Jonathan Gresham against Blake Christian, Matt Cardona with Chelsea Green taking on Joey Janela. All three of them have been doing their own takeoff of the old Randy Savage, Ric Flair angle in WWE with Miss Elizabeth. She was mine before she was yours. Ruby Soho takes on Ally Catch. Eddie Kingston takes on AJ Gray. We've got Team Bandido against Team Gringo. And Jeff Jarrett takes on Effie. You know, they brought in Jeff Jarrett on one of their last shows. They just had Kevin Nash make an appearance at their most notorious show on Friday night. They were in Nash's hometown of Detroit, so they invited him to come do a promo, and he introduced his former paparazzi production stablemate from TNA, Alex Shelley. You know, if they're not careful, they may turn into TNA here. Let's not go overboard here with all the old guys. But the night before, they're hosting their first annual Indie Wrestling Hall of Fame induction ceremony at the Cutting Room in New York City. They're streaming it live and free on their YouTube channel. Lefisto is being inducted by Lenny Leonard. Jerry Lynn is being inducted by Sean Waltman. Homicide is being inducted. Also Ruckus and Tracy Smothers. And Dave Prazak will be inducted by none other than CM Punk. That's Saturday night, and the pay-per-view next Sunday airs at 8 p.m. I am planning at this point on watching the show and going live on YouTube when it is over for the review. So you will probably get a GCW Hammerstein recap on YouTube next Sunday night. I'll keep you guys posted. Some other news and notes before we get into the world of Raw, SmackDown, and NXT. Fightful Select broke the news that as of now, the plan is for the Elimination Chamber match, at least one, I mean, sometimes they do more than one, to take place at WWE's next Saudi Arabia show, which is scheduled for February 19th. Staff in the area is said to have been already briefed on these plans. Dave Meltzer adds that the company is looking at rebranding the chamber from the Elimination Chamber to the WrestleMania Chamber. Yes, it is a terrible name. Although the Elimination Chamber wasn't exactly a great name either. I just think of a fucking toilet whenever I say that. I got my own Elimination Chamber here. But yes, that is a terrible name. The over-branding of things in this company is one of my great pet peeves. But we all should have seen this coming after WrestleMania Backlash last year. They want to prostitute the WrestleMania name as much as possible. I'm surprised they haven't changed the Royal Rumble to the WrestleMania Rumble. I mean, after all, the winner supposedly goes to the main event of WrestleMania, right? Even though sometimes they really don't. But they like to pretend that they do. Fightful also learned that Corey Graves has been cleared to wrestle by WWE doctors. Several sources in WWE told the site that Graves was actually cleared in 2020. Although that has not been confirmed by the company, it's only something that has been openly discussed behind the scenes. And Graves himself has not confirmed nor denied the report publicly. He had been on the company's no contact or no touch list. So I did think it was a little weird when they did the angle on Raw a few months ago where he won the 24/7 title for like 10 seconds. And then Byron Saxton won it. That was the most physicality that Corey Graves has had on WWE television since he was forced into an early retirement in 2014 due to repeated concussions. You know, before that, he held the NXT Tag Team Championship with Pac back in Pac's Adrian Neville days. But apparently there have been pitches, I guess, made for Corey Graves and what they might do with him. You know, I could see him doing a quick cameo in the men's Royal Rumble match. I mean, they've done that with announcers before. They've done that with Jerry Lawler. I think they did it with JBL. But beyond that, I don't know that too many people are clamoring for a Corey Graves return to the ring. Now, if that's something he wants to pursue, then hey, yeah, more power to him. Maybe he wants to end things on his own terms. I'm not saying he shouldn't be allowed to do that. But we've already had Edge come back after 9 years away. Christian after 7 years. Bryan Danielson after 3 years. Those were big names. You know, Graves never reached that kind of status. A lot of people who watch WWE probably only know of him as an announcer. They may not even know that he wrestled. You know, they don't know of him as Sterling James Keenan in Ring of Honor. He does well at the announce desk. I don't see this as a big deal, especially if he's been cleared already for 2 years. We're only first learning about it now. It's not like it's some big breaking news thing. And they obviously see more value in him on commentary than they do in the ring. I think that's where he would excel the most. You might want to sit down when you hear this next news item, this shocking piece of news. But Tammy Sitch was arrested again this week. Or as she calls it, Thursday. I know. I am as surprised as you all are. I have lost count of how many times this woman has been in handcuffs. Legally, that is. In 2012 alone, she went through a span where she was arrested 5 times in 4 weeks. And that was 10 years ago. I was going to say, this woman is a train wreck. I can't even call her a train wreck. It's more like if two trains collided head on and then exploded and all of the debris shot up into the air and it landed on a nearby highway, which then resulted in a 15-car pileup. That's Tammy Sitch. This time, she was arrested in New Jersey and booked on 3 charges, including possessing a weapon for an unlawful purpose and making terroristic threats. Basically, she tried to murder her boyfriend with a pair of scissors. Police officers say that she was involved in a domestic dispute with a man that could have turned fatal. In court documents, they say she raised a pair of scissors into the air towards the victim and threatened to kill him. Perhaps she was just reenacting the whole Sid Vicious Arn Anderson thing from WCW many years ago. You know, they do those Civil War recreations and stuff like that. Maybe that's what she was trying to do. Cops say that an officer witnessed the incident, added that Tammy appeared to be under the influence of drugs or alcohol during the altercation. This was all captured by the police dash cam on their car, so they have it all on camera. She appeared in court on Friday and was released after being ordered to have weekly check-ins. You know, I'm sure there will be some people who continue to make excuses for this woman. Oh, poor Sonny. Oh, poor Tammy. I don't want to wake up one day and read that she was found dead. I'm sure she's got friends who want to see her get her shit straight. But this is a woman who is a complete fuck-up, who has not only put herself at risk in the past, but has put other people's lives at risk. Hence the 6 DUIs that she has been busted for. And those are just the ones that we know about, that she's been arrested 6 times for DUI. It's hard to have sympathy for somebody like that. Now, we'll see if these charges stick or not. But with her record and her having already spent a lot of time behind bars, I can't imagine that's going to help her cause. IWGP World Heavyweight Champion Kazuchika Okada was among the half dozen names inducted into the latest class of the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. Okada joined the Mexican trio of Los Brazos and promoters Jim Crockett Jr. and Don Owen as those elected to the Hall. Okada goes in with the 3rd best percentage in history, 92% of voters. Now, these voters include a mix of current and retired wrestlers, along with wrestling journalists and historians. A lot of people still think it's just Meltzer voting on these things. It is not. But 92% voted for Okada. Only Kenta Kobashi with 98% and Jushin Thunder Liger with 95% had higher totals. Okada joins the ranks of first ballot Hall of Famers like Steve Austin, The Rock, Kurt Angle, John Cena, Jim Ross, Kobashi and Liger. Okada is the best in the world. Okada is the best in the world. You know, 2021 may not have been his best year. I had Bryan Danielson as my wrestler of the year. And I thought Kenny Omega and Roman Reigns were right there with him. But when it comes to big matches, Okada is the gold standard. The body of work that this man has put together over the past decade, and still being only 34 years old, he's a baby. He's practically a child. The body of work at his age that he has already put together is incredible. You know, by the time he's done, he will be in the conversation for greatest of all time. He already is in the conversation. But now imagine if he wrestles another 10, 15, 20 years. You know, you got Murder Grandpa Minoru Suzuki doing matches at 53. That could be Okada in 20 years. I mean, anything's possible if he can stay healthy. And just imagine the matches and the body of work he can still put together in the second half of his career. It's amazing. I do wonder, would I qualify as a wrestling historian? I'm not a journalist, but I need to get a vote one day in this Hall of Fame. And finally, actor and comedian Bob Saget was found dead last Sunday in his hotel room in Orlando. He was on tour and had just performed the day before in Jacksonville. He was only 65 years old. The news broke only a few hours after I uploaded the podcast, so I didn't get a chance to talk about it. But very, very sad to hear that. One of the best TV dads of all time, Danny Tanner on Full House, a show that I used to watch religiously when it was part of ABC's TGIF block on Friday nights. Thank God it's Friday with Full House. It was always Full House first at 8 p.m. And then we had Family Matters with another great TV dad. Shout out to Carl Winslow. And then at 9 o'clock you had Perfect Strangers. And then there was sort of a revolving half hour at 9:30. You know, it used to be this show called Step by Step, which was Patrick Duffy and Suzanne Summers. But then I think Step by Step went away, and then it was this show Going Places, all these other shows that just sort of came and went. But I was a TGIF kid growing up. You know, this is back when TV sitcoms had really catchy theme songs, which they really don't too much today. But Saget had some ties to pro wrestling. He was revealed as the mystery commissioner for Chikara many years ago. And later on, he did an angle for Gabe Sapolsky in Dragon Gate USA for a television show that Saget was doing at the time. I guess they were just filming some footage. Jon Moxley was part of that angle. Jon Moxley and Danny Tanner working together. But it's always sad when somebody well-liked, like he was, passes away unexpectedly like that. You know, we just lost Betty White at 99 years old, and that sucked too. But I mean, the woman was 99 years old. You know, she lived a full life. Saget was only 65 and died alone in a hotel room. And so soon after one of his best friends, Norm Macdonald, passed away, and even he was younger. Norm was only about 60, I think, 60, 61, something like that. It just sucks. It really, really sucks. I was very sorry to hear about that. Speaking of things really sucking, let's talk about Monday Night Raw, which peaked with the opening segment. I thought it was very entertaining. There were a few other positives on the show, too. It didn't suck quite as much as it usually does. But it was yet another very heel-heavy night. AJ Styles was the only fan favorite to pick up a win. It's like they go out of their way to depress these crowds every week. Got to give these people something to be happy about. This company is all about heat. All the time. Heat, heat, heat. I'm surprised they don't give Bully Ray a job on the writing team since they love heat so much. We had Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman in Philadelphia being confronted in the ring by Bobby Lashley and MVP. This after Lashley blew off Shelton Benjamin and Cedric Alexander backstage when they tried to act like the Hurt Business was still together. And Lashley reminded them that there was no Hurt Business anymore, which we already knew. Despite those two wearing Hurt Business t-shirts and coming out to the Hurt Business theme music for the past few months, they never even tried putting them back together. There was never even an attempt to put them back together. I can't even be upset about it because it was never going to happen. Shelton or Cedric or both will end up on the cut list this year. You can bet on that. You can bet on that. But seeing Lashley and Lesnar face to face was great, with Lashley saying that Brock's been ducking him for 20 years. His math's a little off, but that's okay. Brock pretended to not even know who Lashley is, which that I didn't like. But then we wouldn't have gotten that knock-knock joke where Heyman said, "Who's there?" And Brock said, "Bobby." "Bobby who?" "Exactly." And Lesnar called him a wannabe Brock Lesnar, then did a mic drop and walked off. It didn't do Lashley any favors, but there's still time for him to get one over on Brock and for Heyman and MVP to go at it, because they just kind of stood in the background while these two guys spoke. The segment was very entertaining, though. I think it would be damaging to Lashley and all that they have done to build him up as this destroyer if you have Lesnar pretending to not know who he is and saying that nobody beats Brock Lesnar, you're just a Brock Lesnar wannabe, and laughing in the guy's face. If he then goes on at the Royal Rumble to beat him with one F5 in like 4 minutes. That would be horribly damaging to Bobby Lashley. I have no expectation that Bobby Lashley is going to beat Brock Lesnar clean, but all the more reason to think that Brock gets screwed over somehow, because that at least gives Bobby the win and the belt. And if they want, you know, one day they can run it back again. After this was over, Shelton and Cedric ran into the ring to attack Lashley. He laid them out like the geeks that they are. Speaking of geeks, Chad Gable's been booked like a geek for years now. Past few months really hasn't been any different. Geek. But now that geek is a champion. After he and Otis, legitimately his real-life best friend, beat RK-Bro to win the Raw Tag Team titles. I like this. I like the move. I wasn't expecting it, especially after they had already lost once to the Alpha Academy in a non-title match. I thought, boy, you know, them beating them twice, that just isn't going to happen. But I liked the move. You know, Randy Orton eating the clean pin on that World's Strongest Slam from Otis and putting him over just like he did Mark Henry in 2011 when Henry won his first World Heavyweight title. Twice, actually. He did that for Henry on back-to-back pay-per-views. To say this was a much-needed win for the Alpha Academy would be an understatement. The problem is they still have a mostly dead tag team division. It really is just the Street Profits and the Mysterios on the babyface side. But if the idea is to split up RK-Bro, you know, they're one of the most popular acts on the show, but they could really use some big singles names, you know, to add depth to that roster. So, I mean, for so long, AJ Styles was stuck in that team with Omos, and you had Orton and Riddle doing the tag team thing. All of a sudden, AJ is back to being a singles babyface. I don't know where Finn Balor is going to, you know, return. I saw pictures on social media. It looked like he was back home in Ireland, so maybe they gave him some, you know, time off for the holidays with his family or something, but he's been gone. You know, they could really use him back on TV. And now maybe we'll get Orton and Riddle back as singles. You know, we'll see where they go with this before the match. Orton blamed Riddle for their loss the week before. He took a magic marker and wrote "tag in" on one of Riddle's hands and then wrote "Randy" on the other. Well, Riddle did tag Randy in this time, and Randy is the one who lost the match, with Orton being the one to get pinned. Would they have Riddle be the one to turn on Randy Orton and go heel? I just can't picture them turning Riddle heel right now. But we could be setting up for a singles match between these two at WrestleMania, assuming they lose the rematch, because you know they're going to get a rematch. And that would be surprising, too, if they lost three straight times to Otis and Chad Gable. That would be surprising. They have now officially added the word "freakin'" to Seth Rollins' name, right down to his profile on WWE.com. He's used that nickname for years. But now it's in the lower third on the screen, and it's in his bio on .com. Seth freaking Rollins. The announcers wouldn't shut up about it on Monday. You had Jimmy Smith at one point saying that he was covered in Seth freaking Rollins' sweat. What? Why do they do this? Why do they make their announcers sound like fucking idiots? Rollins said the reason he got the Universal title match at the Royal Rumble against Roman Reigns is because he's Seth freaking Rollins. Well, that was quite the explanation. Thank you. I'm glad we figured that out. I waited the whole weekend to find that out. Adam Pearce was on the bump and twisted himself into a sourdough pretzel trying to explain why Rollins got the shot instead of just going with the easiest, most rational explanation and having the man deliver the most rational explanation, which is that Rollins won a ladder match a couple of months ago that guaranteed him a WWE Championship match, and he never got a singles match. There were three other people added to the match at day one. So it's only fair to give Seth his shot. There you go! That's all you have to say. Instead, they had him talk about the history between Rollins and Reigns, and so that's why he gave a member of the Raw roster a shot at the SmackDown title. Big E interrupted, and it was kind of sad. You know, nobody really cared. You know, when he first walked out, hardly any real enthusiasm. He announced that he was entering the Royal Rumble match and said his number one goal is to go to WrestleMania to beat Seth Rollins for the championship after he wins it from Roman Reigns. He's rooting for Rollins to win the title from Roman Reigns. Rollins laughed at him. He said, "You have no chance." This led to a challenge being issued, and Rollins accepted, so the two had a match. And they gave them time. They gave them almost 20 minutes. And Rollins pinned him clean with the curb stomp. 1, 2, 3. Big E was the one who issued the challenge, and he still lost. I agree that the booking during Big E's run did not do him any favors. Even when he was the champion, he never really felt like the guy on Monday Night Raw. He could always go and win the Elimination Chamber, or whatever the fuck they're calling it now. He could always go win the Chamber match, if the Chamber match is to determine a WWE title challenger for WrestleMania. He doesn't have to win the Royal Rumble. And remember, I told you all in the weeks before day one, what did I say on this podcast repeatedly? I do not see Big E walking into WrestleMania as the champion. It was never going to happen because it's almost always about the chase, you know, heading into WrestleMania, the babyface chase. If Big E were to win the Rumble and Rollins beats Reigns to win the Universal title and takes it over to Monday Night Raw, then Big E could fulfill the promise that he made before this match to challenge Seth Rollins for the championship at WrestleMania, but it won't be the main event. I can tell you that. That belongs to Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns. We had an awful segment with Rhea Ripley and Nikki Ash. Almost said ass, but whatever. Same shit. Where Nikki talked about wanting to give back their women's tag team titles, and Rhea pumped the brakes on that idea and suggested, you know what, it might be time for us to go our separate ways. Finally! That's the good news. The segment itself was embarrassing to watch, especially because nobody in the audience seemed to care, but the end result is that Rhea Ripley is finally free of this tag team shit. Nikki did not take this very well. She said, Rhea blamed her for their loss, and Rhea said, no, I don't blame you. And Nikki made a comment about how she thought she was the better wrestler. You know, she was better than Rhea, and Rhea was about to leave. She wasn't going to take any more of this. But she offered a handshake to Nikki so they could part ways amicably. She still believed in Nikki and hoped they could still be friends. Oh, we could still be friends. It was so lame. It was so lame watching this. Rhea hugged her, and when Nikki turned her back to pose to the crowd, they wanted us to think that Rhea was about to lay her out. But instead, when Nikki turned around, Rhea offered a fist bump, and Nikki bumped her fist right in her face. Right in Rhea's face. And then she pounced on her and left the ring, and she mumbled to herself, almost superheroes don't need any friends. So Nikki is the heel, and Rhea is staying babyface. So long as that means this team is over and done with, that's fine by me. At a time when their women's division could really use her the most, Rhea Ripley has been stuck in tag team hell with a wannabe superhero. I'm glad this is finally coming to an end. The funniest thing on the show was watching Omos in the ring with the job guy they brought in for him to squash. I believe that same person actually was on AEW Dark this week, I believe. Was it, I think it was Dark. But he was obviously, yeah, there's a big size difference between Omos and this other guy. And they're standing, you know, basically, I can't even say face to face. They're basically, yeah, this guy's head was about level with Omos's crotch, and Omos is looking down at him, but he's standing there, and the referee is between them. And the mics picked up Omos asking the referee if they should do the height thing. Should we do the height thing? Let me know when. The height thing being where he puts his hand in the air to show how tall he is as compared to how tall his opponent is. From now on, that is to be called the height thing. Edge had Beth Phoenix on the cutting edge. Not much to this. You know, they aired a package on the Glamazon for the people who don't know anything about Beth's career, or they might have forgotten about her. I had forgotten that the Royal Rumble where she eliminated the Great Khali was the same Rumble that Edge won in 2010. Miz and Maryse came out and they played a similar video for Maryse. And Edge said that Maryse is great and all, but Beth could deadlift a Buick. And he would be worried if he had to fight her. He also made the comment as he introduced his wife before Beth came out that she's got thighs that could... what was the exact comment? I forgot to write it down. It's like she's got thighs that could crack walnuts or something like that. I don't know that she took that as a compliment if you look at the look on her face when she came out. But Edge is a lucky man. But while Miz was busy putting over his wife, she's standing behind Miz, you know, kind of in the aisleway, and she gets this very concerned look on her face after Edge made the comment that, you know, my wife could deadlift a Buick. Maryse looked a little concerned about this, and she walked to the back. She turned and walked to the back while Miz was still yammering on, not even realizing his wife had left. You know, it's all they can do is talk show segments. It's the same thing they did to build up the Edge against Miz singles match. Just trading back and forth, cutting edge, Miz TV. Miz TV, cutting edge. Now we get another cutting edge. Next week it'll be Miz TV. Tomorrow night. I'm waiting to see if they do an arm wrestling contest in the next 2 weeks between Beth and Maryse. And then we had Alexa Bliss. The female fiend is back. She has reemerged. Now she's in therapy. I feel like I should be in therapy after the last couple of years of all the fiend and the female fiend and all the bullshit, all the segments. She's in therapy after what happened at the end of her feud with Charlotte Flair, when Charlotte ripped Lily the doll to shreds. Instead of pushing the reset button and bringing her back as herself, they're either keeping the character because of all the merch money they make off those fucking dolls, or they're going to try to explain how she reverts back to her old self. And that's fine. If they have a storyline in mind for how she transforms back into the old Alexa Bliss, then that's fine. Her psychiatrist reminded her of what happened with Charlotte, and then her whole demeanor changed. She started throwing things and smashing things and trashing his office. The therapist ran away and she screamed as the segment ended. I think it is very likely that she has not gotten over Charlotte and therefore will eliminate Charlotte from the Royal Rumble match. But I have no interest in seeing her actually winning the Rumble itself. This was not as embarrassing as it could have been. I was expecting worse. But I do hope they're winding down with this stuff very soon. And Doudrop beat Liv Morgan and Bianca Belair in a triple threat match to earn the right to challenge Becky Lynch for the Raw Women's Championship at the Royal Rumble. Ric Flair still will not shut up about Becky Lynch. My God, the tweets that he inevitably deletes, the rants on his podcast about her using the man and calling herself the man, which they're not even doing much anymore. That's why they started calling her Big Time Bex. They're trying to get away from all the man stuff. He won't shut up about it. I own it. I'm the man. It's mine. He sounds like, you hear these stories every now and then of these old guys that just, they have dementia or something and they lose their minds and they find them walking down the side of the road in their fucking PJs. This woman is living rent-free in this guy's head. It's pathetic. This guy's Ric Flair. All right, one of the greatest of all time. living legend. And he cannot get this woman out of his head. It's sad. It's really sad. Doudrop was coming off 3 straight television losses to Bianca Belair. Liv Morgan was coming off 2 straight losses to Becky Lynch. But I was hoping Bianca Belair would not win, because they would be nuts not to blow that off at WrestleMania. Bianca hit a moonsault on both women before giving Morgan the KOD, but Becky interfered and broke up the pin. That right there tells you who she views as the biggest threat. Or threat, as it were. The biggest threat to her championship is Bianca Belair. Bianca chased after her and ended up getting tossed over the announce desk. Inside, Doudrop gave Morgan a bonsai drop for the win. That was a surprise. That means we now have not one but 2 heel versus heel title matches booked for the Royal Rumble, involving 2 different spouses. But it does a few things. It keeps Bianca out of the title match until WrestleMania, which is the smart thing to do. It keeps Liv Morgan from a 3rd match with Becky Lynch, which she did nothing to earn. In fact, even in this match, look at what happened in this match. When Bianca had the match won, she hit the KOD, it was Liv Morgan that she dropped with the KOD. And she had pinned, dead to rights, before Becky interfered. Morgan was about to take the losing fall. And then later, she did take the losing fall. She ate the pin from Doudrop. So she really has no justification for another match with Becky Lynch, unless she wins the Royal Rumble, but that ain't gonna happen. Doudrop against Becky Lynch is a match we haven't seen before, and for all the people who were upset, as I was, with what they did with her when they first called her up and they put her with Eva Marie and they gave her that ridiculous name, if you were such a big fan of Piper Niven's work, then you should be happy to see her getting a big championship match at the Royal Rumble. She's not going to win, but she has the chance to go out there and show people what she can really do. We saw some of that in the matches with Belair. But there's no bigger stage that this woman has been given than the one that she's getting on the 29th. So be happy for her. Or were all these people just posing as pretend fans of her work? I'll let you decide. This show is still very bad, but there were a few bright spots this week. And now you know what they were. Now, when it comes to the importance of men's grooming, I want you to pay attention to what I have to say about this. This is very important. I know we have a lot of men listening to this podcast. You've heard me talk about Hawthorne before. It's not only people like you and me that use Hawthorne products. Some of your favorite athletes do as well. And think of the way those guys sweat like a beast when they're on the field or when they're on the court. Steph Curry says that he can't live without their body wash. Zach LaVine of the Chicago Bulls, he used Hawthorne's quiz to tailor his perfect cologne. Even Tyrod Taylor of the Houston Texans, he leaned on Hawthorne to upgrade his grooming game. He wanted a brand that works as hard for him as he does on and off the field. Hawthorne is a premium men's grooming brand that uses data from hundreds of thousands of customers to recommend perfect products for your body chemistry, your skin type, your hair type, your lifestyle. These products will give you the confidence that you need each and every day to look and feel your best and smell your best too. It's about time you upgraded your body wash and your shampoo and your deodorant. I've been next to enough people on the subway where I wish they were using these Hawthorne products. It would have made my commute a lot more tolerable. It's one of the reasons I enjoy not commuting anymore and working from home. First, you take their quiz. And I like how thorough it was with the questions they ask you. They ask me stuff like what my skin type is like on my face, what my hair type was, what cologne do I wear, what my drink of choice is. Now, you may not think that kind of thing matters, but it really nails down what matters most to me. It was very easy to fill out. Didn't take more than a couple of minutes to answer all their questions. At the end, I got their essentials bundle with all the products tailored to my body type and my lifestyle. Like their gentle and mild face lotion. There was a cooling shampoo for my scalp. But my favorite by far is the cologne set. It comes with 2 different colognes, one for work and one designated for play. That's my favorite of the entire set that I ordered. I've gotten some compliments about it too. Kind of hose myself down in this stuff. But you really don't need too much of it. Even better, Hawthorne stands by its customers, so if you're not completely satisfied, and you will be, they'll retailer your products for free based on your feedback, and they'll even pay for the shipping. What company does that? There's truly no risk involved. Looking your best has never been easier. So get ready for whatever comes your way this season by taking Hawthorne's quiz today. Go to hawthorne.co and use promo code SOLOMONSTER to get 10% off your first purchase. That's hawthorne.co, promo code SOLOMONSTER. Hawthorne.co, promo code SOLOMONSTER. And make sure you put that .co. It's not .com, it's not .net, it's not .org. It's .co. You can thank me later. I'm sorry to say, SmackDown was not that much better than Raw. The Viking Raiders are the new number one contenders for the tag team titles after winning a very formulaic, there's that word again, fatal four-way over Los Lotharios, Jinder Mahal and Shanky, and the team of Cesaro and Mansoor. Mansoor, I've heard it both ways. What an exciting tag team division they have on Friday nights. Oh boy. Cesaro and Mansoor are not a real team. The other two are heel teams. So the Vikings were the only ones that really made any sense. Yeah, they've got Corbin and Moss. If they want to have them chase after the titles, they could do that. They could put Nakamura and Rick Boogs together as a team if Shinsuke drops the Intercontinental title to Sami Zayn, which he should. But that's still a pretty uninspired list. Speaking of Sami Zayn, God bless Sami Zayn. He's very good at playing this conspiracy-tormented character, this conspiracy nut. He almost makes this Johnny Knoxville stuff tolerable. Almost. This week, he was going to attempt a Jackass-type stunt like Knoxville used to do on his show, and I guess he does in his new movie, where he jumped into a shopping cart, and he was going to have these two guys launch him down the aisle, up a skate ramp, over the ring, onto the other side, where there was a crash pad on the floor in front of the announce desk. I don't know how many of you picked up on it, but I got a kick out of Pat McAfee on commentary comparing Sami Zayn's jump to Evil Knievel going over the Grand Canyon, and Michael Cole correcting him and saying it was the Snake River Canyon, and it didn't work out. And the reason I was amused by that is, and I wonder if that was even a line that, actually, it probably was a line that Vince McMahon fed to him, because Vince McMahon was an investor in that debacle, and he lost his ass on it. 2 years after that, he and Linda filed for bankruptcy. Evil Knievel made out with $250,000, and Vince lost $250,000. He got played for a fool on that one. Although, I guess, hey, he got the last laugh, though, because Evil Knievel is dead, and Vince McMahon is a billionaire. But I'm guessing Vince fed McAfee that line. And was poking some fun at himself, right? All's well that ends well for Vince McMahon. I think things turned out pretty okay for him. But anyway, Sami Zayn had no intention of doing the stunt because if you saw the way that it was configured, it was impossible. Not even Ricochet, I don't think, could have pulled this one off. Well, maybe Ricochet could have. He kept stalling and stalling. Wait a minute, I have to check and see if it's safe. You know, just give me some time here. Finally, Nakamura and Boogs came out. Boogs cut his hair, by the way. He cut his hair short. No more rock and roll hair. He was jacked, though. Holy shit, this guy looked like fucking Ken Patera out there. And he press-slammed Zayn onto the crash pad, and that was the end of the segment. Aaliyah was back. She's been found. Now we have to find out what happened to the Protector. What happened to Xia Li? Where's she been? She made two appearances and she's been gone. She was on their holiday tour a few weeks ago, so she's not hurt. But they have kept her off television. I guess there's been nobody to protect. With the Royal Rumble coming up, though, they could use her in there. But her name hasn't been mentioned at all. But Aaliyah was there to wrestle Natalya, who was gloating about holding 3 world records in the Guinness Book of World Records. And tonight, she promised to break the record of 3.8 seconds for the fastest women's match. And Natty jumped her before the bell, and the referee was going to throw it out because he said Aaliyah can't continue, and Aaliyah said, no, I could go, and he said, okay, and he allowed the bell to be rung, and as soon as the bell rang, Aaliyah immediately rolled up Natty for the win to set the new record for the fastest ever women's match, at 3.17 seconds. They billed this as Lita's first appearance on SmackDown in 20 years. This was a very last-minute thing. They literally contacted her the day before to ask her if she would fly in and do the show, and they flew her in later that same day. Michael Cole interviewed her in the ring and asked why. Why now? Why the Royal Rumble? And she mentioned main eventing, all the things that she's done. First woman to main event Monday Night Raw when the women had never done that before. I think she mentioned Trish, but she did that already before that. She did that with Stephanie McMahon. So she had the chance to do that, and, you know, she's in the Hall of Fame. But when I was around, the women didn't have a Royal Rumble for themselves, and now they do. And she thinks she's got one more run left in her. They completely ignored the fact that she was already in the Royal Rumble back in 2018. But, you know, they're acting like this is her first. Or maybe back then, I guess, she didn't think that she had another run left in her, but now she does. I don't know. But this brought out Charlotte Flair. And she promised to eliminate Lita at the Rumble. Lita made fun of Charlotte's giant pumpkin head. Flair brought up retiring Lita's best friend, Trish Stratus, at SummerSlam 2 years ago. And Lita then hit her with the safest twist of fate that you have ever seen. This was fine. You know, the thing that it does that I like is that it creates a little side story, you know, heading into the Royal Rumble with Charlotte. That match is going to be all about Charlotte Flair, the way that the Men's Rumble was all about Brock Lesnar a couple of years ago. And whoever eliminates her is going to be, you know, is going to be a big deal. It's going to get a big reaction. That's going to be the big moment of this year's Women's Rumble. I think there's a good chance it'll be Alexa Bliss doing that. And Charlotte probably will eliminate Lita, because Lita is not going to WrestleMania to challenge for the title. Now, Fightful.com had the story this week that Lita had discussions with AEW last year about possibly coming in to work a program with Britt Baker around the time of the All Out pay-per-view in September, but both sides failed to come to an agreement. Can you imagine the reaction of Rebby Hardy if Lita had signed with AEW? I mean, even as recently as, I feel like it was only a couple of years ago, a few years ago, she was popping off about her on Twitter when people were tagging Rebby in, like, old photos of Team Extreme. Yeah, they're trying to get her all stirred up. And she was going off on Lita and calling her, you know, certain names. And, boy, you know, she's ride or die when it comes to Matt, I'll say that. And she made it very clear what she really thinks about Lita. But look, I'm glad it didn't happen. I'm glad she didn't go to AEW. I'm happy that fell through. If the idea was to do a match at All Out between Britt Baker and Lita, we ended up getting a really good match between Britt Baker and Chris Statlander instead. And even though Statlander lost, it was more important, I think, to have one of their own stars in that match than Lita for what may have been just a one-shot or a very short-term thing. That's something I would expect to see WWE do, because they very often will bring back old stars, legends, big names. Tony Khan obviously will bring in, as he has no issues bringing in former WWE talent, but not usually for a short, like, one-and-done type of thing. If they wanted Lita as an undercard attraction against somebody, that's one thing. WWE did that with Charlotte and Trish at SummerSlam. That was a fun match, and it wasn't for a title. Baker and Lita for the championship, that I'm glad it never happened. There was a show-long storyline with Naomi confronting Sonya Deville in the back about Deville screwing her over in Naomi's match with Charlotte, where Sonya had come out and she kept changing the rules of the match. Sonya reminded her that you can't touch me when I have my jacket on because I'm a WWE official. So I guess the pants and the vest don't count. It's the jacket that gives her all of her power. She should join Jacket Time in NXT. Naomi walked off, and Sonya, first she was complaining about how cold it was in their office. Adam Pearce agreed. He said, yeah, it's really cold in here. And he starts fiddling around with the thermostat. Then later on, it was too hot. And when Pearce went off to go try to find a maintenance person to fix the problem, Sonya took off her jacket. And the moment she took her jacket off, Naomi reappeared and said, oh, it looks like your jacket is off. and she was ready to pounce, but Adam Pearce came back and said, look, you're right. You got a raw deal in your match with Charlotte, so we're going to run it back again next week. These segments with Deville and Naomi have gotten way too repetitive. But they're obviously dragging this out to WrestleMania. So we're going to keep getting more of it. Because they got a lot of time to kill between now and then. Sheamus beat Ricochet in a good match. It's always good when those two are in the ring together. Madcap Moss pinned Kofi Kingston clean in the middle of the ring. Former WWE champion Kofi Kingston. I find Kofi's shtick with the accent. He does the Sir Kofi stuff. He was reading a royal proclamation before the match from King Woods, who's out hurt with a calf injury. He got hurt in the street fight with the Usos on TV a few weeks ago. So he read a royal proclamation from Woods, who I think is going to be out about 6 weeks or so. He's not going to be in the Rumble. And when he does the voice, when Kofi does the voice and everything, I just find him beyond irritating. But I can't say it gave me any real satisfaction to see him get pinned like that, because the Happy Corbin and Madcap Moss stuff is some of the absolute dirt fucking worst stuff on WWE television today. This act absolutely sucks. As does Sir Kofi, the Sir Kofi stuff. That sucks too. I didn't like anybody in this segment. Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins went face-to-face at the end of the show on Friday. And while there were a few good lines, especially the line that Roman got off about Seth's wife, when it was over, I was left very underwhelmed. I'm sure the match is going to be much better than this segment turned out to be, especially the end. I just thought it was very lame. Rollins tried to get him to do a Shield fist bump at first. Reigns said that's beneath him. Rollins pointed out that every time we're in the ring together, one-on-one in a championship match, I've beaten you. There's three things in life that you can count on. Death, taxes, and Rollins beats Reigns every single time. But Roman said, brother, I'm in God mode right now. And he said Seth dresses like a clown, and if he had his choice of a megastar from Monday Night Raw to face off with, he would have picked Rollins' wife over Seth himself. And that's when the Usos tried to jump Rollins, but he managed to avoid them and he escaped down the aisle. I think the whole heel against heel dynamic hurts things a little bit, but it left me wondering if this is the start, the early start, of a Seth Rollins babyface turn. Could we be heading towards babyface Seth Rollins? You know, him beating Big E clean the way he did on Monday also made me think that they might be slowly shifting him in that direction. And maybe they are. But he's not there yet. And until the Rumble, I think there may be some more awkward moments where it's tough for the crowd to choose sides because they've been conditioned to dislike both of these guys and not cheer either one of them. I mean, Roman still gets cheers, but, you know, it's just like, oh, well, who are we supposed to root for here? I am looking forward to the match, though. I think the match is going to be kick-ass. Both title matches at the Rumble are going to be great. Even the Rumble matches themselves, you know, they can be hit or miss, but the Rumble has always been, you know, one of my favorite shows all year. So they've managed to put together a pretty solid card so far, all things considered. It sucks that Sasha Banks got hurt, though, and she will not be in the Women's Rumble. And condolences to Sasha Banks and her family. I read that her father just passed away on Friday night, Snoop Dogg's uncle. From what I understand, I don't think Sasha had much of a relationship with her father, her birth father, but it is still her father. You know, when I did my 2022 predictions last Sunday, I predicted that the women's title matches at WrestleMania would be Becky Lynch against Bianca Belair. I mean, I've been saying that for probably a month and a half now. And I said Charlotte Flair would defend against Sasha Banks. And I hope, even though she's going to be out for a little while, she ain't going to be gone for that long. You know, supposedly, she could probably be back later sometime next month. And so I hope that despite the injury, she could, you know, come back with more than enough time to build to that match against Charlotte at WrestleMania. Now, over on the NXT side, you knew this was coming. You had to know that this was coming. PW Insider broke the news this week that going forward, the NXT creative team will no longer be operating independently as it had under the Paul Levesque regime. Up to now, NXT had basically operated in its own little bubble, creatively. No longer. The NXT creative team has been informed that they will now answer to and report to Bruce Pritchard and Christine Lebrano, their senior vice president of creative writing, who just started with the company last year, just as the Raw and SmackDown creative teams do. This was to be expected. With them getting rid of most of Triple H's team, now they report directly to Bruce. I always said NXT was at its best when Vince McMahon forgot that it even existed. And the moment he took that tour of the Performance Center a few months ago with all of his lieutenants, all of his captains, that was the beginning of the end of NXT as we knew it. Walter, who either has already moved or will be moving to the United States to be part of the 2.0 brand, wrestled his final match for NXT UK this week. They gave him a big send-off against Nathan Fraser, the former Ben Carter. They billed it as Walter's last stand. I had it as my match of the week. Great battle. If you have not seen it, I recommend checking it out. It was the best match I saw all week. Walter had done all he could do on that brand. He held the championship for 870 days. I mean, what more could he do? I wanted him to come to NXT a long time ago, and then they blew it up and turned it into something completely different. But Walter can only make the show better, and I guess it keeps him away from the main roster for a little while longer, which is good for him, even though they could really use him right now on Raw or SmackDown. On the show on Tuesday, we had the new NXT champion, Bron Breakker, in the ring for a short promo for the first time since beating Tommaso Ciampa. He got his new side plates on the belt. How long now? How long until we get a new belt? Because you know that's coming next. It has to be. It has to be coming. What's that thing going to look like? So he got chance of You Deserve It, and he was thanking Tommaso Ciampa, called him a great performer, a great human being. And said that after the match, Ciampa paid respect to his father, who was sitting ringside last week. Indeed, Rick Steiner was there. He did get into the ring and celebrate with his son after he won. I wish they would have saved that for television, but apparently you're not allowed to mention this Steiner name on TV. Apparently there's some kind of gag order on doing so. But I think that would have been a great moment. But that's me. So, it was a good promo, and as he was leaving, they do this thing now on NXT where when somebody is leaving to go to the back, they play the next person's music, whoever's coming out for the next segment, before the other person has had a chance to leave. And so they inevitably pass each other in the aisleway, and they kind of give each other the stink eye. And that's what happened here with Bron Breakker and Santos Escobar, who came out for his match against Zion Quinn. So maybe a little tease there for something with Breakker and Escobar. Escobar did beat Quinn with the stipulation that Electra Lopez would leave with the winner. This storyline has done nothing for Zion Quinn. And the finish here did nothing to help remedy that. This guy looks like a badass. He's got a good look. He looks like somebody you would not want to fuck with. But they book him like another dumb babyface. He believed that this woman had a thing for him. He had a thing for her, and he thought that she had a thing for him. And in the end, she kicked him in the crotch. He got played. And Escobar hit the Phantom Driver for the win. Escobar is a great person for these newer guys to be working with and all, but you know, he deserves a real program of his own. Which is why I would be very interested in that Breakker-Escobar feud that I just, potential feud that I just talked about. Cameron Grimes was back this week. It's been a minute since we've seen him after his feud with Duke Hudson finished up. He got a win over the debuting Damon Kemp, real name Bobby Stevenson, the brother of Olympic gold medalist and Raw superstar, Gable Stevenson. Malcolm Bivens was out scouting for Diamond Mine during the match, and it didn't look like he was out there scouting Cameron Grimes. I think Stevenson would be a good fit for them, especially now that they're down a member with Hideki Suzuki being released. Not that he ever really did anything, he just kind of stood there. Later in the show, Grimes confronted Carmelo Hayes and Trick Williams out in the parking lot as they were leaving, or trying to leave. So it looks like Grimes is going to be going for the North American title next. I like it. Grimes and Hayes. That should be very good. On commentary, Vic Joseph mentioned that Von Wagner was fined and suspended for beating up some of the planted fans in the audience last week. And then a few segments later, he was told that Von Wagner was already reinstated and had his fine paid for. But we weren't told by who. That'll likely end up being Robert Stone. And I'm not sure that's much of an upgrade given his track record, but if Wagner needs one thing besides a charisma injection, it is somebody to do the talking for him. This was a bit of a shocker. Joe Gacy and Harlan lost to Idris Enofe and Malik Blade in a qualifying match for the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic. I thought they might even win the entire thing, and they're out before they ever got in. After Harlan failed to yield to the referee's five count while he was pummeling Malik Blade in the corner, the referee disqualified them, and so Enofe and Blade are in, Gacy and Harlan are out. Yesterday, WWE announced the names of the remaining seven teams in the men's Dusty Classic. They are MSK, who won it last year, Briggs and Jensen, Jacket Time, good grief, the Grizzled Young Veterans, Andre Chase and his student Bodie Hayward. You know, Dusty had a son named Cody, and now Bodie may win the cup. Joaquin Wilde and Raul Mendoza of Legado del Fantasma and the Creed Brothers round out the bracket of eight. It's got to be MSK or the Creed Brothers, I would think. That's probably your final match, in fact. I don't have the bracket in front of me if they've put it out yet, so I don't know where they are position-wise, but I could see an MSK Creed Brothers final. You know, MSK won it last year. They've been telling the story, though, of them trying to get that rematch against Imperium. They're trying to climb back and get that tag team title rematch. So I'm thinking MSK repeats. Tony D'Angelo got a big win over Pete Dunne in a crowbar on a pole match, bro. It's no wonder the head writer for NXT, his last name is Russo. True story. His name is Johnny Russo. Coincidence? I think not. I say this is a big win for D'Angelo, who's looked more than capable in his last few matches. Bron Breakker and Carmelo Hayes, you know, they get a lot of love, but D'Angelo can work. But I say it's a big win because Pete Dunne has been unusually protected for much of the past year plus on NXT. You know, it looked like they were building him up long-term for a shot at Tommaso Ciampa's title. That's why they were keeping him unbeaten for so long in singles matches. Given the fact that he lost here, and, you know, we've read about him and Ciampa doing dark matches before Raw and SmackDown, and I think they were both on Main Event last week, we may be seeing the last of Pete Dunne very soon in NXT. And I hate that it might happen right as Walter is coming in full-time, but maybe we can get a send-off match between the two of them if Dunne, if he does get called up before he leaves. Maybe we can get a quick program between him and Pete Dunne. Pete Dunne and Walter. We got the in-ring debut of the narcoleptic ninja herself, Wendy Chu, tagging with Persia Parada and Indy Hartwell against Casey Catanzaro, Caden Carter, and Amari Miller. The Mei Ying gimmick did not work out for Karen Q, and so now, instead of playing a thousand-year-old lady, she just acts like one by constantly falling asleep. She was all curled up on the apron like a cat. All curled up in her team's corner, resting her head on a pillow. I think this would be a great gimmick for Monday Night Raw. Just send out Wendy Chu during any boring segment. This woman would have more television time than Betty White did in 8 decades. Chu did eventually get tagged into the match, and she woke up, and she hit some suplexes, and Indy Hartwell picked up the win for their team. They seemed to be impressed and surprised with their partner when it was over. You know, if AEW has the guy who wrestles with his hands in his pockets, then I guess there's no harm in NXT having the woman who wrestles in her pajamas. But this gimmick will have a relatively short shelf life, like Tian Sha did. I was into that at first, but then it just dragged on for far too long without any kind of real progress being made, so that's why they dropped it. Speaking of Tian Sha, we had Boa. Boa is still doing weird stuff. And he wrestled Solo Sikoa to a double countout. They brawled into the halls of the Performance Center, where Boa caught Sokoa with a fireball to the face. Jim Cornette throwing a fireball in Ronnie Garvin's face, this was not. Boa had been wrestling the match without his, you know, that white face paint that he sometimes wears, like his war paint. But after the fireball, when the camera panned back to him, all of a sudden, he had the face paint on. So they're still trying with Boa for now, but I predict that Boa finds his way onto a certain list this year. And I am not trying to be cynical, it just comes naturally. And also, you know I'm probably right. I just don't see much of a future for him. I really don't. I mean, think about this. If you've seen Boa, there's nothing overly spectacular about his work. You know, he's okay. Do you look at Boa and think, man, this, you know, they got big things planned for him? Even in NXT, they got big things planned for him. Let alone if he gets called up to the main roster. They'll have him running around with Tozawa. Chasing after the 24/7 title, hiding in garbage cans. This guy's got no future. Future endeavored. That's about the only future he's got. That's maybe why it's hard for me to get into the guy. I don't see a future in this company for him, so why get invested in somebody who's not going to be there in 6 months? And AJ Styles defeated Grayson Waller. I thought they had a good main event, very good showing for Waller. Styles went for the phenomenal forearm, but Waller fled out to the floor before sprinting back in through the bottom and middle rope to give Styles that rolling stunner that he does for a near fall. Styles did manage to hit the phenomenal forearm on his third attempt for the win. After the match, Styles said he wanted to introduce Waller to one of his good friends, and LA Knight's theme hit. I don't think we've seen LA Knight since just after War Games. Knight beat him up all over the ringside area, shook hands with AJ, posed with him in the ring to end the show. I remain baffled as to why LA Knight is not on Raw or SmackDown at a time where they could desperately use somebody like him as a heel or a babyface. He could do either or. I am baffled by why he is still toiling away in NXT. Let's do a few mailbag questions and then get the hell out of here. If you want to email me, you may do so. TheSolemnMonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in, like Peter in Atlanta, GA. Is there any truth to the rumors that Chris Jericho or Jon Moxley might show up as a Forbidden Door surprise in the Royal Rumble match? Or that Moxley could have some involvement in the Roman Reigns-Seth Rollins match, given their history? I will answer this with one word. No. And I saw a few things about this. Peter was not the only one who has asked this question or has talked about this on social media. And so I wanted to address this here. I don't know where this is coming from beyond just people randomly speculating just because of what happened with Mickie James being announced for the Women's Rumble, and then there was a report that maybe WWE is open to having other quote-unquote forbidden door names. If I am Tony Khan, if Chris Jericho came to me and asked me and said, Vince wants me in the Rumble, he's going to allow me to be in the Royal Rumble, on what planet would it make sense for Tony Khan to agree to something like that? What is gained if an AEW star is allowed to be in the Royal Rumble match? They're not going to win. They're going to get dumped out by somebody. There is absolutely no benefit for AEW in agreeing to do something like that. And I would like to think that Tony Khan is smart enough to hear something like that and go, yeah, that's not going to happen. Even Mr. Forbidden Door, I would like to think, is not dumb enough to agree to something like that. Okay, so I'll let my AEW guy go in the Royal Rumble match and get dumped out by fucking Madcap Moss. Yeah, oh, that's a great idea. Or dumped out by Charlotte Flair. Oh, that's fantastic. That's wonderful. There is literally no good reason to allow an AEW star into the Royal Rumble, nor would Vince McMahon want one in there anyway. So I don't know where this got started, but let's nip this in the bud and put this to bed, please, because this is one of the stupidest things I saw all week. The answer is no. Daniel from Ohio. Longtime listener. Much appreciation for all the content. Thank you, Daniel. Says, I had an idea that I wanted to run by you and see if you can see this happening. since WWE seems pretty dead set on The Rock, not The Rock, Brock rather, they'd love The Rock, but he says pretty dead set on Brock against Roman at WrestleMania. I thought of an interesting way that we could get there. This idea is Brock winning over Lashley and also entering the Rumble and winning. After all, Brock has entered the Rumble before as champion. This allows both Brock and Roman to look strong and win their title matches and also get to the WrestleMania main event. This also would be a nice little surprise during the Rumble since no one would see Brock entering after he already won his match. This could then go one of two ways for Mania. One way would be title versus title, not a unification per se, just title for title. The other way would be Brock relinquishing the WWE title, stating that he came back for Roman and Roman's belt. This could lead to a tournament leading up to WrestleMania for the WWE title, with the finals being at Mania, or even better, the semis on night one and the finals on night two. Not an ideal way to get to this match, but they obviously had other plans before Roman had to be out of day one. And this seemed like an interesting way to get to their match without either one of them needing to lose at the Rumble. Daniel, thank you for your question, but I think I hate everything about what you just wrote. And I mean that in the nicest possible way. But I know you wouldn't want me to lie to you, would you? So I hate everything about what you just wrote. I got to shoot straight with you on this. I absolutely do not want to see Brock Lesnar retain his title and be in the Royal Rumble match. That would be ridiculous. And that would rightfully get shit on by everybody. As it is, just me pitching the idea that Brock would lose and then end up in the Rumble and win got a lot of hate. And I had to sort of, argue my way through that with a lot of people who just can't see the bigger picture here. But for Brock to beat Lashley and then go into the Rumble and win the Rumble, that is so ridiculously counterproductive. I don't even know where to begin. So I don't like that idea at all. Either he loses and then ends up in the Rumble, or he wins and he's not in the Rumble at all and you let somebody else win it. So that's number one. The idea of doing title for title and not having it as a unification also doesn't serve any purpose. If they were going to do winner take all, then you may as well just unify them and have one unified world heavyweight champion. So without the unification being part of it, I don't see any reason to even do title for title, champion against champion. But what's even worse is that if you go with that idea that Brock is going to retain over Lashley and then he's going to win the Rumble anyway, and then you're going to go to WrestleMania, and then you could have Brock maybe relinquish the title, just give it up and say, I don't really want this thing. That alone is damaging to the WWE title, and just with that one statement, with that one action, you're relegating it to second-class status. Now, that title already has second-class status, usually when it's on somebody other than Brock Lesnar, but all you're doing is telling people, boy, this belt really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if Big E gets it back. It doesn't matter if Lashley wins it. It don't matter who holds it. Brock Lesnar didn't even want to have anything to do with it. He just threw it away and gave it up. And if you do the semifinals on night one, you're not going to headline with it on night two, because no matter what, you're going to headline with Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns. So again, it just doesn't work. It just does not work. I know it's a creative way to try to go about doing it. I get what you're trying to do, because that way both guys don't have to lose. It's okay for one of them to lose. Or both of them, if there's a screw job involved. If one screws the other and they both fuck each other out of each of their belts, or if Heyman turns on Brock and Brock loses, but then he comes back and wins the Rumble, then it doesn't even matter then that he lost to Lashley. Because he's got the shot. He wins the Rumble. He ends up against Roman. Nobody's going to care that he got fucked over by Lashley, because they're going to know that it was the Bloodline's fault or Paul Heyman's fault. But Lashley could go around saying, I beat the Beast. Our one and only match. I beat Brock Lesnar. And maybe down the road they come back and do a rematch between them. But you can't have Brock do both. You can't have him win one and then go in the Rumble to win that too. That's just beyond ridiculous. Stephen from Isle of Man, UK. Seeing as we are well into Royal Rumble season, I thought I would give you a Rumble-related question. Buy, sell, or rent on these world title matches that took place at the Royal Rumble. Triple H against Cactus Jack, Royal Rumble 2000. John Cena against Umaga, Last Man Standing, Royal Rumble 2007. Brock Lesnar, John Cena, and Seth Rollins, Triple Threat, Royal Rumble 2015. He says, all three are favorites of mine, and I really don't think the Cena versus Umaga match gets spoken about enough, but I would love to hear your thoughts. That was a very good match. I enjoyed all three are quality matches, and the Triple Threat in 2015 is one of the best Triple Threats that WWE has ever done. That being said, if I had to rank them 1, 2, and 3, I'd probably go Triple H and Cactus 1, Triple Threat 2, and the Umaga match number 3. I don't think the Umaga match was as good as those first two. Sean from San Diego, when I heard the Sasha Banks injury news, it really bummed me out. With Sasha having a history of injuries, it got me thinking, do you think in the near future that Sasha would be better fitted in the special attraction role, a la Brock Lesnar, Goldberg, or The Undertaker? She is such a great wrestler and bumper that I think having her in small doses would be better for her longevity and would make her feel more special. What say you? I don't know that Sasha Banks would like that very much. Sasha Banks, she's a wrestler. She wants to wrestle. She's not an old lady. So I'm not sure that she would want that. I don't really like that idea either. I don't think she has to be on television wrestling every week. I agree with you on that. Yeah, you talk about her injuries. I don't know that Sasha has had any more or less injuries than any other person in that company. I don't look at her as being injury prone. You know, and what happened to her in that house show match with Charlotte, if you watch the footage, was a complete freak accident. You know, her foot got caught underneath her when Charlotte kind of brought her down. She's lucky it's just a sprain and it's not anything torn or broken, which is why she should be back with plenty of time for WrestleMania. But I don't think of Sasha. When I think of injury prone people, you know, there's some names that pop up. Tegan Knox is somebody who is just, you know, besieged by injury problems. I don't look at Sasha Banks as being overly injured a lot. Frankly, I think Sasha, she doesn't appear very often anyway. I mean, she was off doing the Mandalorian stuff, and then she was off TV for a while for some other reason, and I feel like she's already missed a lot of time. But no, I wouldn't reduce her to Goldberg or Undertaker levels. I think that would be ridiculous when she's still, you know, relatively young and still has many good years left in her. So, I think that you want to get her back on TV as soon as possible and, you know, just hope for the best and just treat her like you would treat anybody else on that women's roster, because Sasha Banks is somebody who I think ought to win the championship of WrestleMania and be the number one person coming out of Mania in that SmackDown women's division. And if she's going to be the champion, then she's got to be around. You can't have a champion. Well, I mean, I guess they've done it with Brock, but you know, you really want to have Sasha Banks win the championship and then, you know, be on TV twice a month? I don't think that's something that she would want. I think she wants to get in there and work. Daniel from Hamburg, Germany. Which of these four WrestleMania matches should have been the main event? Only pick one. Flair and Savage, WrestleMania 8. Hogan Rock, WrestleMania 18. Taker Shawn Michaels, WrestleMania 25. Or Taker and Punk at WrestleMania 29. Taker and Punk absolutely should not have been the main event at WrestleMania 29. I don't know. You got Rock and Cena on the card. I was there. The match was not that good. But Rock and Cena is going to be the main event. You know, the thing that I've argued is that Punk should have qualified to be in that match to make it a triple threat. So Punk did deserve to be in the main event, I think, that year. But Taker against Punk, that should not have been the main event. The other three, they deserve to be in the main event. I think you could definitely argue that. The one that I have to go with, though, and it's not even really that much of a hard question to answer, is Hogan and Rock at WrestleMania 18. That was Hulk Hogan's first WrestleMania match since WrestleMania 9, almost a decade earlier. Hogan was Mr. WrestleMania. There may not be a WrestleMania today were it not for Hulk Hogan being positioned as the top star in that company. I mean, all those WrestleMania main events that he was a part of. So he comes back, even though he's a heel and he's, you know, black and white NWO Hogan. He goes to Toronto and he's treated like a fucking hero. He gets a hero's welcome. The people love him in the Sky Dome. Rock is already one of the biggest stars in the company. They build it, you know, the past against the present, you know, icon against icon. There was no bigger match on that WrestleMania card that year. Triple H had the big comeback story from the quad injury, and he was challenging Chris Jericho for the title. I get that. You know, in a perfect world, you want the title to go on last. That's one of those years where I think you make an exception. There are certain matches that come along, like Rock and Cena the first time in 2012. They're so big, and they're such a big attraction. Even without a title, you make an exception, because that is the main event. There is no other match on the card, title or no title, that is going to have the kind of appeal that those matches are going to have. And you had to know that the crowd was going to react in a big way, and they were going to be burned out by whatever came on next. And Triple H found that out the hard way. Funny enough, you've got two matches on this list where the person who got burned was Triple H. Because he had to follow these matches. He had to follow the Shawn and Taker match too. As soon as that match was over, he said, he went to Randy Orton in the back and said, "We're fucked." They knew. Of course they knew. Shawn and Taker should have been the main event too, but Hogan and Rock, you put me on the spot, I have to pick one, it's got to be Hogan Rock. You got to end that show with Hogan and Rock. And the way it ended too, with the NWO turning on him and Rock saving him and Hogan, that's the big babyface turn. And you end the show and you do what they didn't do, which is then you play Real American and you have him and Rock pose and that's how you go off the air. And he raises Rock's hand at the end and puts him over, and that's how you end WrestleMania that year. So anyway, thank you for the questions. You know, again, I am as honest can be when it comes to these questions. So do not get offended if I do not agree with your idea, or if I, you know, give you reasons why this is a ridiculous thing that you have pitched, because I don't come on here and lie. I don't come on here and sugarcoat it. You know, it's nothing personal, but I got to tell it to you like it is. I get some emails sometimes with some great ideas, and I get some emails sometimes with some god-awful ones. If you have a question, don't be afraid to send them on in, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I do read everything you guys send me, even if I don't get to use them all on the show. I promise you, I do see them all, and I appreciate all of the feedback. I am going to be back with you on Wednesday. We're going to be doing two streams. The one that I mentioned earlier for YouTube channel members only, a 1992 Royal Rumble watch-along. I can't play the actual match on screen, but I will have it off screen. I will be watching the match. I'll be on video, though, and I'll be interacting with you in the live chat, talking about the match, talking about some fun facts and what was going on at the time, behind-the-scenes type stuff that I've, you know, read about and learned that I'm fascinated by. So we'll talk about that and do that on Wednesday during the late morning, early afternoon. Watch for the poll. I'm going to put the poll up in the community section on the YouTube channel. That'll be for the channel members. And you guys can vote on what time you want to do it. And so that'll be a lot of fun. Later that night is the AEW Dynamite stream. That'll be open to everybody. As always, if you want to get in on that watch along and you're not a channel member, again, you can go and click the Join Now button. It's on the channel. It's this white Join Now button. You know, you click it. It doesn't make you a member or anything right away. It'll show you the two membership tiers. You choose the one that works for you. But everybody who is on either tier will have access to this watch along to join me on Wednesday. And then I guess we look ahead to next weekend, and I am planning on covering the GCW show. Big pay-per-view for them. Next Sunday night, the return of Jon Moxley, if he doesn't show up first on Dynamite this week. And of course, I'm always working on something. So follow me on Twitter @Solomonster, Instagram, TheSolomonster, trying to be a little more active on there. So follow me on there. I put some pictures up from the House of Glory show as well. And I will see you next Sunday for episode 740 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off, now in our 15th year, celebrating 15 years this November. One of the longest running podcasts in the world when it comes to professional wrestling is right here, and I thank you for your support. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solo Monster Sounds Off.
Beth Phoenix is standing in the aisle. She is making these over-the-top. She's mean mugging the camera, and she's just standing there. Thank God Kevin Dunn played her music, or else she might still be standing there. Poor woman was like, she was frozen, like she was trapped in carbonite or something. I don't know what was going on.
The Solo Monster Sounds Off, each week bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solo Monster on Twitter at Solo Monster.
Solo Monster.
Solo Monster.
Solo Monster Sounds Off.